The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Sarah Corbett Lynch was just 8 years old when her father Jason was murdered by her stepmother. Now, Sarah has just published a book recounting family life with her stepmother Molly Martins, her experience of the Martins murder trial, and the grief she still carries over the loss of her father, which left her and her brother Jack orphaned. The book is called A Time for Truth, subtitled My Father Jason and My Search for Justice and Healing. And Sarah's with me now. Sarah, good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, this is an astonishing book. I mean, it's vivid, it's heartfelt, it moves you to tears, but it's so accomplished and you're only 18.
Thanks.
It's extraordinary. Why did you decide to write the book?
Well, I decided to write the book because we had no voice. We weren't allowed to give evidence. We were under a gag order, so we couldn't even speak to media. And when I lived with the Martins, I had no voice either. I had no control over my own thoughts. And I wanted to tell my story. I wanted people to understand what actually happened inside of our home.
Now, the way you've structured the book, every chapter has the beginning of what you're going to say in your victim impact statement. And it allows the construction of that statement throughout the book, which is a very interesting device. But bring us back to the very beginning. I mean, your mum died when you were very small, so you don't have any recollection of her.
No, I don't.
You had to reconstruct what she was like.
Yeah, I was very lucky. My dad kept a suitcase full of my mom's stuff, so I can actually still wear her clothes today, you know. So even after 18 years, I have a sense of her. I have a lot of her things and her belongings because my dad had kept them away.
Your dad had kept them, and they travelled with you to America when the whole thing with Molly Martins started. I mean, your dad ultimately married her. Yeah. What was that like at the beginning? You had to start a new life. How old were you when you left Limerick?
I was around four.
So do you have much memory, or can you reconstruct the memory of what that Limerick was like? You've come back, of course, to Clare and Limerick. So
yeah. I remember Limerick before we left. I remember like family and seeing them and my cousins who are now my brothers coming over to the house, and but I do remember the beginning. I remember when we first moved to America, it was exciting. We were excited to go. Everything was bigger there, you know. The weather was better. The house was enormous. It was beautiful. And I remember my dad and Molly were really happy. They were going around the house picking out where they were going to put certain furniture, and they told me they were going to get me a real princess bed because my dad used to call me his little princess. So it was exciting in the beginning.
Now, you began to treat Molly as your mother. I mean, she was legally your stepmother, but yeah. You began to treat her as your mother. When did you perceive, as a very young child, that things were not as they should be?
Molly's behaviour towards me and Jack and towards my dad was, from as long as I can remember, was not okay. But it was my normal. So there were certain things that Molly did that felt wrong, but I didn't know any different. So, you know, I was 5 years old and Molly started telling me that my dad killed my birth mom. That's not okay. It's not true. But I didn't know any different and I didn't know how to react to it.
So therefore you said nothing to your dad even. You didn't say anything to him about what she was indoctrinating you with.
Yeah, Molly, she got into my head at a really young age, and Jack's as well, and we knew not to disobey her. We knew not to tell my dad certain things, and she didn't have to say it to us. You know, we knew that we would get punished. If we did bad in a swim meet, we didn't eat. She wouldn't give us dinner. And if I did bad or Jack did bad, we could have punishment, you know, so we knew not to.
You were walking on eggshells all the time.
Yeah.
But you learned how to navigate all of that.
Yeah.
Now, what about your dad? He was a loving dad. He gave you a framed picture, which you actually had to keep hidden.
Yes. My dad gave me a framed picture of him and my birth mom, Mags, at their wedding day. And he put it in a lovely princess pink case. And I had to hide it because Molly didn't like speaking about my birth mom. And one day she came into my room and saw it out.
You mistakenly left it out, yeah. And she spotted it.
Yeah. And she came in and she picked it up and she started screaming at me saying, "This is not your mother. I'm your mother. This woman is dead." And she threw it down the stairs. And she was hysterical. And then all of a sudden, she just stopped, walked down the stairs quietly and walked over the shards of glass like nothing had happened. And when my dad came home, he saw me cleaning it up and I told him some story that I dropped it down the stairs or I fell. And I still have that photograph today and it's my dad super glued it together. I still have the cracked case and my dad put new glass in it.
Now, your dad sounds like a really loving father. I mean, he was doing the best he could for you, reading you bedtime stories and all of that. So this was the vision, the experience you have had of your dad. And yet this woman was trying to paint in your head a very different experience.
Yeah. She told me from a young age that my dad was a bad dad and that he was a bad husband. But my memory of my dad is him bringing flowers home for Molly and him telling Molly that she looked beautiful when she got dressed up and wanting to spend time with us. He was really family orientated. You know, he moved to America for Molly. She felt homesick and he moved because that's what his wife wanted. So he moved for her and he got us into the sports. He got us into basketball and cheerleading and he started teaching some of the teams so that we felt comfortable. You know, he loved being a dad and he loved being a husband.
And he loved being in America. I mean, it suited him down to the ground and he had lots of good friends who, of course, stood by him after the whole thing happened. They didn't believe any of the... His friends did not believe any of the stuff.
Anyone that knew my dad wouldn't believe what was said about him.
Now, the terrible night when it all happened, it appears that you might have been drugged.
Yes. I remember being given tablets by Molly and some sort of cranberry juice that night. And when I woke up later on that evening, I had these bed sheets I had my entire life and I still have one of them today. So these weren't new. But when I woke up, it was spiders and lizards crawling all over my bed. And when I tried to get out of my bed to go down to Molly and my dad, my legs felt like jelly and it was like I was on a moving boat. And later I found out that Jack was also given tablets before he went to bed.
Do you know now what those tablets were?
No.
Then the whole thing unfolded without you knowing. Yeah. And you were, after it was Molly's father who made the call. Sounded quite cold-blooded almost in making the call. "I think I may have killed him," he said to the operator. They didn't start CPR until they were instructed to by the operator. And even then, it was hopeless because of the damage they had done to your dad, which is just appalling. I mean, one of the jurors actually vomited when shown pictures of what had been done to your father, Jason.
Yeah.
You were taken down from your bedroom down to the basement.
Yes.
And there was a kind of a reunion that happened later.
Yes.
As we fast forward to the second, the plea deal trial, you met the man who actually accompanied you down the stairs.
Yes, I met Clay Dagenhart, the officer who brought me down the stairs. And it was a very emotional
reunion.
He came over to me and he said that, "I don't know if you remember me." And I knew I recognized him from somewhere. I just couldn't place it. And as soon as he said that he was the person walking down the stairs, I started bawling. And I kept hugging him. And we talked and I met his kids, you know. And it's amazing how one of the worst nights of my entire life, I had someone that shielded me and protected me from seeing things that I could never unsee.
And he might not have been there that night. Yeah. It was kind of a...
He wasn't meant to be working. He worked overtime that night. And it actually turns out he had a baby girl named Sarah at home. So it affected him a lot more than it would have.
Yeah. And he shielded you from what you might have seen as a child, which is probably just as well.
Yeah.
Your life then descended into, I suppose, chaos because this is before Molly and her father are arrested. And of course, Molly's mother is involved in all of this as well in at least... Say nothing kind of way.
She was named in the wrongful death, but she was never investigated or charged.
Yeah. So what happened to you then, and how soon did you know what was going to happen to you? Did you, yeah, I mean, here you are, your mother, your original birth mother was dead.
Yeah.
She died of an asthma attack, and we'll come back to that in a little while because it becomes germane to all the proceedings. Your father has now been killed, and there is your stepmother, Molly Martins, who was involved in his death, no matter, you know, even before blame is attributed, she and her father were involved in your death and admitted as much.
Me and Jack were placed in the care of the Martins, which, looking back on it, it makes me wonder that if it was the other way around, if the police had shown up and Molly was in the state that my dad was, would me and Jack have been put into my dad's care, or would he even have left there not in handcuffs? And Joan, we had no legal guardian with us. Tracy and David, my dad's sister and brother-in-law, were meant to be our legal guardians, but we were placed in the care of the Martins, and we stayed with them for almost 2 weeks.
Now, what was your sense of that when you were with them at that time with Molly and her father? I mean, how were you? Can you remember how you were feeling about them, because you knew that they were involved?
It was weird because the Martins act like nothing had happened, so it was hard for me to actually comprehend that my dad was gone. You know, Molly acted like she had a new lease of life. She was teaching Bobby's, her brother's younger daughter, how to swim in their pool, and you know, they were having barbecues, and we went to the beach, and the only odd thing that was happening was, you know, the hushed whispers. And me and Jack both saw my dad's laptop, his phone, and his drive from his computers in Bobby Martin's house, and they were never put into evidence. You know, so there was a lot of things that were happening that in the moment me and Jack didn't really understand what was going on. But looking back on it, it's pretty clear what was happening.
The status of her father as a former FBI, do you think that had a lot to do with the way they were treated?
I believe so, yeah.
That there was a kind of respect for a law enforcement and...
Yeah, I believe so. It's very clear in Tom's interview that he establishes himself as a colleague and not a suspect. And he's very cool, calm and collected throughout the entire interview.
Just to outline what their story was that Molly was being abused by your father, and that in a desperate act by her father to help her, they attacked your father, Jason.
Yeah.
But they did so in such an extraordinary way, in such a brutal way. And the evidence was given that the blows had come, that he was on the bed, that he was defenseless, effectively.
Yeah.
Was there analysis of his blood to find out whether he was, like yourself, drugged?
There was, and the police weren't going to do a toxicology report until Tracy asked for one, because the Martins were saying that my dad was drunk, and there was actually, the amount of alcohol in his blood was less than driving limit in Ireland and in America at the time. And he also had traces of, I think it's called trazodone.
Yeah.
And that's a prescription that Molly had been prescribed about 3 days beforehand.
Now, all of this, I mean, there was a first trial and they were convicted. But then the legal system and the defence lawyers got to work and they managed to get that verdict thrown out.
Yeah.
What was your reaction and David and Tracy's reaction, who became your parents effectively? Yeah. What was their reaction to that outcome? Because going back and forward to America for trials and hearings and so on, very difficult.
It was devastating for all of us to hear. I mean, Tracy and David have been over and back to America over 25 times. And to hear that their convictions had been overturned was devastating.
And the prospect then of a retrial was being actively discussed. And then suddenly, the bombshell.
Yeah. If we had a retrial, I was hoping that I'd be able to give evidence. And that was really important to me. I wanted to sit in the court and look at a judge and tell him what happened, because a lot of the reason why the Martins got their convictions overturned, a lot of it is because of me and Jack, because we lied in our interviews with Dragonfly, and we lied to the GSS because we loved Molly and we trusted her. And we were told that if we didn't lie, that we would never see each other again and that we would be taken away.
The whole idea of your lies was to suggest that your father was abusing Molly, and therefore this was domestic violence, which was resisted by Molly and then her father. And as a result, your dad died.
Yeah.
And this was the story she wanted you to help her reinforce.
Yeah. And in my interview, you could hear me saying, Molly told me. And at one stage, I say something like, sorry, I made a mistake. Can I say that again? And I just don't know how they didn't see that me and Jack were working up a script, you know?
Yeah.
And we had been coached for years. Yes, the Martins sat us down before we went into those interviews and told us that we needed to say certain things, but we had been told that for years.
So you were hoping that there would be a retrial and you would be able to give your evidence as an older person. What age were you at that point?
I was 16 or 17.
So a lot more, I suppose, reflection on what you'd been through and processing it and all the rest, and realizing how much you had been manipulated.
Yeah.
How did you receive the news then that the authorities had entered into a plea deal?
We got it in an email, and I wasn't actually with my parents at the time, so they had to come and collect me. I was at a friend's house, and it was like the world just kept kicking us while we were down, you know. And we never thought that they would get a plea deal, and for me, I believe manslaughter is, you know, a travesty of justice, really. My dad deserved so much more from the justice system. And, you know, me and Jack deserve to be able to have a silent story. My dad was silenced by the Martins. The Martins were not telling the truth. And me and Jack lived inside that house. You know, we could speak to what actually happened there. And it was very important for us to let people know that it wasn't just the night of August 2nd.
Now, there was going to be a chance for you to say something, but very limited. And this is where the victim impact statement comes in. But the whole process, given there was a plea deal and they were going to perhaps just get time served, or perhaps there was a possibility, remote though it might be, of a very long sentence, up to 17 years, but the judge indicated early on that's not going to happen because before this they have blameless records.
Yeah.
So you're never going to get 17 years.
Which, you know, my dad had no record in Ireland or America. He never did anything to anyone and he wasn't there to stand up for himself. And it was difficult because the Martins both got character witnesses. While they were sitting inside the courtroom, they could speak for themselves. But me and Jack were denied the chance to speak for my dad.
Now, the unkindest cut of all in these proceedings was the trying to blacken your father for the death of your birth mother. I mean, that was disgusting.
Absolutely. And it was one of the hardest things when sitting in the courtroom because my aunt was there the night that my mom passed away the entire time. She was living with us at the time. And I kept asking the prosecution why they weren't saying that. What we didn't know is that the plea deal is basically written out before it even happens. They couldn't. They could only say it in closing arguments. So we wasted our time. We wasted the judge's time. They spent days speaking about my mother's death.
And they had these experts coming in saying this is strangulation, da-da-da. Your mother died of an asthma attack.
Yes.
And that's the truth of it, and the beginning and end of it. And yet they these experts who never knew her, who were looking at medical reports from Ireland and interpolating them in a way that was totally unconscionable.
Yeah, and it was really devastating for us and for my mom's family as well because she's passed away 18 years ago. You know, and she had nothing to do with this and they couldn't just let her rest in peace. And I think through the book, it gives it a good insight into the judicial system and the challenges that families do face.
So when you did get to say something, what was that like?
It was a mix between I felt empowered that I was able to speak on my behalf in a courtroom. And also very challenging because I was very emotional. But I'd watched Jack, my older brother, speak. And I'd watched other family members speak. And it was important to me too. Because I don't want this to happen to another family. And it is happening. You know, I've gotten through. I'm a survivor of domestic abuse. My brother's a survivor. My dad is a victim. But this is happening in real time. There's people who are living in really difficult circumstances right now. And it's important that we acknowledge that.
The ultimate outcome, there was very short time spent subsequent to that plea deal behind bars for the pair of them.
Yeah.
And the former man who wanted to, Tom, who wanted him to appear like he was a colleague of the cops, he comes in wearing different clothes, kind of casual clothes. Yeah. I'm just an old grandfather, yeah. Helpless, poor old creature.
Yeah.
Playing again to the court.
Yes. And, you know, I don't have any feelings toward the Martins now.
I was delighted to see there isn't a picture of them in the book.
No. It's important to me because they have taken so much from me. And I've spent more than half my life in the judicial system because of their actions. I've lost my dad. They tried to ruin his good name and tried to bring my mom into it. And I don't want them to have any bit in my future. You know, they've had enough time on my mind.
It's like an American nightmare. It really is. The book itself, it's the search for justice, and in articulating what you've done, you certainly have, I think, found justice for your dad, because
Thank you.
About him, you've the honesty, the truth of it, the kind of man he really was, the kindness of him, the gentle nature he had. But the healing is what you're looking for yourself.
Yes.
Have you achieved that, do you think?
I think with grief, you're always going to be trying to heal. But I definitely have found so many tools to help me, which is really important about the book as well. You know, me and Tracy call it my toolbox. So, you know, I learned how to sing, which has helped me to express myself. And
Jar of Hearts is your...
Jar of Hearts is my scream song. But talk therapy and writing, because when I came back to Ireland, I couldn't say some of the things that I'd gone through because I was so young and it felt like I shouldn't be saying those things. And Tracy said to me one day, if you want to just write it down, leave it on my pillow, we can talk about it. And that became an amazing help to me, to the point where it's kind of led me to where I am today, that I've been able to write down my experiences.
Yeah. And brilliantly so. There are a number of heroes in the book, besides yourself and your brother Jack and all you've gone through, but David and Tracy.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah, definitely heroes. And I knew that from the moment they came in and Tracy gave me a hug. And when they got custody of us, because it was almost like a sense of home. They had my dad's accent, you know. They were the first people to ask me, was I okay after my dad died? And said, I'm sorry that you lost your dad. No one else did that. And as soon as we came home to Ireland, they just were like, you're a part of the family now, you know. And Adam and Dean and my sister-in-law Kelly and my nephew Max, and we're all really close. And I wouldn't be here today without them.
Now, you're only 18.
Yes.
You're a great swimmer and you've done so many things, and obviously a musician and now an author. What lies ahead? What do you want to do?
I'm planning to study English and drama next year, and I've also become a qualified surface applied and commercial diver, so I think it'll be a mix between the two, which I don't know if you can mix them, but...
You're a young woman of many, many parts. I have to say, I was just awestruck by the book. I couldn't believe it was written by an 18-year-old, really accomplished. It's called A Time for Truth, subtitled My Father Jason and My Search for Justice and Healing. Sarah Corbett Lynch is its author. And Sarah, thank you very much for joining us on the programme today.
Thank you for having me
on. The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.